Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And as you may know, the network is run by volunteers. There are about 100 of us, but we do have expenses. So we'd like to ask you to contribute a little something if you can. If you enjoy the programming we produce, then we hope that you will take a moment to go to any New Books Network page and hit the button that says Donate to NBN. And whether you contribute or not, we'd like to thank you for listening to the network.
Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week, we have the co-authors of the book Sport Beyond Television, The Internet, Digital Media, and the Rise of Networked Media Sport, published by Routledge in 2013. The two writers of the book are Brett Hutchins and David Rowe. David is a professor in the Institute for Culture and Society at the University of Western Sydney, while Brett is associate professor in the School of Media, Film, and Journalism at Monash University. Both have done research into various aspects of popular culture, media, and communications. And this book, Sport Beyond Television, is part of a larger collaborative project that has also produced a collection of essays written by an international team of scholars titled Digital Media Sport. And that book was also published by Routledge last year. As Brett and David discuss in our interview, the ways that we follow sport have been dramatically transformed in the digital age. And certainly one small piece of that transformation is that an interviewer in the United States can record an hour-long online conversation with two academics in different cities in Australia and then make that conversation available to listeners around the world. The internet is indeed an amazing thing. Here is my conversation with Brett and David. On the line from Melbourne, we have Brett Hutchins. Brett, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Sydney is David Rowe. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So we typically begin each podcast with a bit of background about the guests. I will say to start that both Brett and David are sociologists by training. Both have research interests in media, communications, and popular culture. So I'll turn to you both and ask you to explain what spurred your particular interest in sport and media. So who wants to tackle that one first?
After you, Brett.
Thanks, David. My interest in sport, like many people's, comes from a family background, having played sport at a number of different levels. When I reached my late teens, I, of course, arrived at university where I studied journalism and had the pleasure of actually reading much of David's work as an undergraduate. So the fact I'm working with him now is both surprising and very pleasing. And since then, I've gone on to teach media, communications, journalism, and indeed digital media, which of course helps to explain what we're speaking about today.
Yeah, in my case, it was a little accidental. I had an interest in sports growing up in England. Young men were trained as being young men by playing sport. But academically, it took me a while to get into it, and my area of interest is popular culture and media, and my PhD was actually on the popular music industry in Britain in the post-punk era. And I was working with a colleague, Jeff Lawrence, now at the University of Queensland, and we started talking a bit about sport, and he was working on something. And then, you know, as colleagues do, we got working together on some ideas, and I kind of stumbled into it. And I suppose that this comes through in a book I wrote in the mid 90s, which was called Popular Cultures, and was about the relationship between sport and popular music. So kind of put those two together. And in recent years, increasingly around journalism and media, so sport's very much a part of that. So sport's never too far away for me, but then sport is also never too far away from the media, which is why I guess we wrote this book.
Mm-hmm. And you've done a couple of book projects together now. And Brett, you mentioned that you had read David's work as an undergraduate. So what launched your partnership?
Partly because of my PhD supervisor was also someone who's co-authored with David, and over the years David was kind enough to, of course, answer my emails and encourage me in various ways. And this over time sort of led to a dialogue around the possibility of a project moving beyond television and looking at the role of sport online in digital media and indeed mobile communications. And I think one of the benefits of how we came together is the fact that, of course, there's a deep historical understanding of the evolution of different media forms and the way in which, of course, television's never gone away. It's possibly more powerful than ever. But when we came together, of course, David's long-standing expertise in the study of popular culture and television and my more recent work around digital media, particularly online and social media, made for a pretty compelling combination. So, and that's how the project came about, which was, of course, it was funded by a research council here, the Australian Research Council, and it's led to a companion book, which is an edited collection called Digital Media Sport, which extends a lot of what we've presented in sport beyond television and also problematises and sort of helps to set some new questions that probably need to be answered at this moment.
Yes, I mean, Brett and I are intellectually different generations, and it was, you know, particularly good when he proposed that I get involved in the work around new media. I guess most of my work had been in legacy media, and at the end of the two editions of probably my best known book, Sport, Culture, and the Media, The Unruly Trinity, I dip my toe in the water of new media platforms and so on rather tentatively, and working with Brett gave me the opportunity to jump in.
So in saying that you were tentative about getting into new media, I guess that would tie in with what you write about in the book, that there are quite a few executives of sports leagues and teams who are also reluctant to dip into new media.
Yeah, it's interesting speaking. The book's based on a series of 45 interviews with people working at all levels of the sports and media and technology industries, both sports specialists and more general sort of media professionals. And the actual sports organisations in the last few years have turned a real corner in understanding why digital media is so important. But it's been interesting to see how fast that change has come, because a lot of what the book presents is an ongoing dynamic of trying to hold on to established revenue streams, particularly mm-hmm. around live broadcast television, both free-to-air and cable or pay and satellite, while attempting to opening additional streams and how to turn a dollar from social networking and websites and mobile media. And wanting it both ways in many cases, while, you know, trying to deal with the fact that, of course, the architecture of broadcast is different to that of online, and the control of content is much harder, and the barriers to entry are, of course, much lower. So a lot of the older sports executives, many of whom had played sport at a high level over the years, they're in their, 50s, 60s, 70s, and of course have grown up in an era of print media and broadcast limited options on broadcast television. So I've then spoke to, and David also spoke to, many of the tech professionals they hired, and a lot of discussion went on around how it was important to sort of get them to understand the need to make the change. And of course we live with that change every day just because of the emergence of dual screen, second screen television and things like that now people tweet while watching baseball and football and all those sports.
Yeah, I think in a broader sense as well. I mean, we call the book Sport Beyond Television an arresting title. But I guess we were using the beyond in two senses. One is literally what has coming along after television, but also a sense, a questioning of whether new media developments are transcending or indeed destroying television. And it was important, I think, not to fall into the traps of, on the one hand, being in denial and say, look, there's nothing happening. You know, television will, as we know it, is the dominant media sport form and will remain so. And these other developments in digital media and so on are just add-ons, or they're incidental. They don't mean too much. And then there's the other apocalyptic version, which is that television is dead, the legacy media have died, and it's that stuff is all so 20th century. And kind of lays waste to the world of television and other legacy media. And what we've really tried to do in the book is to not to fall into those traps, to try and judge the evidence insofar as it's available, as where we recognize both the way that television is proving adaptable and resilient, but is also operating in a much more complex environment and is interacting with all kinds of other platforms.
We'll get into television and the resilience of television in a second. I want to ask something, though, about Brett. You had brought up, you had mentioned just the rapid development of new media and online media. And that was something that struck me as I was reading that book. And I think it's something that we lose track of. We've become so accustomed to going online and using new media. I think that we lose sight of the fact that this is really a very recent development. And I was thinking of it and reading your book that, you know, when I made my first trips to Europe about 15 years ago, I still had to, furtively sneak looks in the International Herald Tribune to keep track of my teams back in the States. So that was pretty recent that, you were still reliant on print media and on television. And now when I go overseas, I open my laptop and I can watch whatever I want.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting thing to live through change that happens so fast, but quite quickly just feels so normal. And the book problematizes that experience in a lot of ways, which is why we spoke to people. I mean, we wanted to speak to people who make decisions about what will be shown, when, where advertising placed in the midst of all this change. And I think in terms of the book's success and the parts that people have obviously given very positive feedback is around that, because things like Twitter, Facebook, live updates online, both to mobile and to desktop or laptop, it's sort of hard to remember that these things have really only been around since the advent of broadband media and 3G. And depending on which countries you're talking about, and the picture does vary depending on which countries you're talking about, you're talking around the mid-2000s and even into the late 2000s. And yet at the same time, the dominance of platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube has become they've become so entrenched that, you know, it's like they've been here all the time, and the fact is they haven't. And while at the same time, you've also seen the economic power of broadcast television also increase, and that's quite counterintuitive. And I personally became frustrated as someone who reads a lot and teaches a lot and researches a lot in the area of digital media around the dominance of work in the area of the publishing industries, the music industries, the film industries, yet I would argue possibly the most valuable form of live media content on the globe at this moment is arguably sport. And when you looked at the literature, it just wasn't there. In other words, if you want to understand leading-edge change in the media industries, it also draws on incredibly deep-rooted historical processes because of sport's endurance as a cultural form, that we need to look at sport and live sport. And sort of that's where the book lays out the case in a number of different areas, including social networking, computer and video games, the television industries, and so on.
And I'll ask you to expand on that, because that's an important point that you make at the beginning of the book, is just how important live sports broadcasting is for media companies. So can you expand on that and explain just how large this is?
Yeah, well, it's become ever more dominant, and David certainly can speak to a lot of what's going on in the major broadcast networks because of his recent work. But it's become ever more dominant because of the live event. In an age of time shifting, of an age of online piracy, including the live streaming of sports events, the broadcasters in many ways have lost control of the schedule, because people watch when they want, where they want. And that also makes it very difficult to sell advertising, because, you know, it's not really clear where the eyeballs are. And live sport is the one form of programming. Things like the Super Bowl, the ice hockey final at the Winter Olympics, the upcoming World Cup final, where we know that millions and millions and millions of people will be watching. So when you've seen, the ability to attract huge, massive audience deteriorate to a certain degree around many television formats, with perhaps the exception of reality television, that makes sport all the more important in understanding the media economy generally.
I just add to that liveness is absolutely crucial to the economic appeal of sport, which of course flows from its popular appeal. A live event, its value degrades very quickly, as soon as the moment passes. And there are very few areas in television now that are, we would regard as a so-called appointment television, that, you really have to be there. You want to be there at that moment. All the kind of time shifting that goes on in other genres, such as, excellent works of drama and that kind of thing, that really doesn't work with sport. You have to be there. The so-called live broadcasting of history, that's the key, I think. Now, around that event, you can then build a massive amount of programming and other textual content, which will draw lots of people. But it really needs the live moment. That is the lure. That is the source of the power. That's the one of the last cards that the broadcast corporations can play.
And you make the point as well that, unlike, say, a popular film, people don't return to watch the match over and over again.
Yeah, we refer to it as a perishable product.
Yeah.
Which it has enormous, its value is maintained at its point of transmission. Sport, and this anything any sport fan knows, or any sport person who's watched sport with even a minimal degree of interest, will know that once you know the result, there's not too many people, by contrast with the overall audience, that will continue watching the game over and over. And that means you're painting a very different picture to programs that are extremely popular on retransmission or DVD box sets that people love watching it over and over. And, there's plenty of examples of those, everything from The Simpsons to Seinfeld to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and so on. Sport fits into a different category. And because of its centrality to a lot of the decision-making, even around things like changing sort of modes of audience measurement, I would suggest that anybody who's particularly interested in understanding what's happening in the media industries globally at this moment needs to come to terms with the events, marketing, technology to go on around things like the Winter Olympics, the Soccer World Cup, NHL finals, NASCAR, you name a sports event, and of course the English Premier League, while at the same time, as I say, this is only really something that has increased in its power over the past decade or so, which is, of course, where we've come in.
Yeah, I would just add to that. The live sport event does have lots of spin-off you know, material, you know, quiz shows and, you know, all that kind of thing. And some people do buy, you know, highlights reels and, you know, all that kind of thing and greatest matches ever played, those kinds of things. There are films and novels and all kinds of things around that. But if we take the live event is really of the essence, as we've suggested, and the sports, the kind of dyed-in-the-wool sport audience tends to exaggerate its size and power. You know, the kinds of people who will buy, you know, DVDs of greatest matches and that kind of thing. I mean, they're a significant market, but they're rather small. The big thing about the live event is it drags in lots of people who actually don't care about the sport that much. They're only kind of half watching that, but they may not even understand the rules, but they're dragged into the spectacle, the noise, you know, the vivid color of it. And I mean, a classic case I would imagine is the Super Bowl. I mean, lots of people only watch the Super Bowl for the halftime entertainment. They don't understand gridiron, and in many cases they don't care about it, but they're attracted to the spectacle and the spectacle that is happening now,
and the social aspect of it, that you gather together, you have a lot of food, you're with dozens of friends, and I've been to plenty of Super Bowl parties, and you might have, say, five men sitting on the couch watching the game, and the other two dozen people in the house are all milling around and chatting and eating food.
And that, sure. You know.
Yeah, sure. That they're very social. They're social occasions, and the sport may be central or incidental, but they create opportunities for what we would call sociality, and that doesn't only have to happen when you're in the same place as the other people. So that's one area that we've been very interested in, all the uploading and downloading of content that goes on during big sports events. That, you know, it is a profoundly social activity. It's not, you know, the mythical person sitting on their own just watching a screen.
I want to turn back to this question of how television has fared and what its future will be in the internet age. And you write at the start of the book, you make the point that television is not being replaced by the web and digital media. Your words are that it's being repositioned and redefined. So can you expand on that and explain how is the internet maintaining yet redefining the broadcast of sports on television?
Television's being repositioned in a number of ways. First of all, there's the actual notion of at the level of production. Okay, so a sports event is no longer planned only in terms of an outside broadcast unit, commentators, and what will be seen on the screen. Sitting alongside that, you'll see social media units, you'll see, of course, online streams, which will be shown in some territories and not others, depending on existing broadcast rights. You'll also have what sort of will be offered on mobile, and what are generally termed over-the-top services online, where you'll see other parties attempt to sort of draw value from that game by generating conversations or posting highlights and so on. The level of the actual what you see on screen, you've also seen that change because of the fact that everybody will be familiar, or most people who have watched sport will be familiar with the idea of Twitter feeds and what the fans are saying and the commentators making reference to that. Indeed, the commentators taking part in those sort of interactions going on Twitter. And at the level of the audience, it's the case that major sports organisations, and I use that term major very deliberately, these are generally very wealthy, very powerful media entities, both sports organisations and media companies, are delivering the event via, you know, three or four screens, depending on what's going on, up to and including live broadcasts sent to public places in major cities, to mobile screens, to tablets through apps, and, of course, in the emergence of an app economy, as well as what someone will be accessible through a web browser. And then, of course, there's the television event itself. And you see those screens and those texts and those experiences and those sort of production levels of production interweaving through each other, sometimes seamlessly, sometimes not so. and it creates a situation that really does need a careful amount of thought to pass, to pull apart and to understand its implications, even in terms of changing models of audience measurement. We've grown up, or the, you know, for several decades it's been the idea that advertising is sold according to a relatively agreed on set of industry standards, and now there's an attempt, particularly during major events, to measure where eyeballs are, both on the television screen, but also what's going on social, what's going on online, what's going on mobile, and attempting to value those as well. And so we're at a really interesting point in history where the media industries themselves are trying to actually come up with agreed upon standards of how value through the attention of an audience is arrived at.
I guess I would just add that, you know, I guess we have traditionally thought of television as the dominant medium of sport. And it's particularly important because at any one time, only a small proportion of the world's population can be co-present with the event. So as soon as sport kind of modernized, it needed to be communicated. The live enclosed event needed to be communicated to a large dispersed audience, increasingly a global one. Now, television is in most cases a national form. It's dominated by nations, and the international transmission is not typical of television systems. It happens some of the time, but not most of the time. I think that what we're seeing with you know, the introduction of what we call digital network media is to some degree the television is not as tight a nation as it once was. This has been facilitated by a range of technologies, and therefore we're moving into reasonably uncharted waters, which is how do you take systems, broadcast systems, which were designed around nations, and take them into other spaces using other technologies. So there are, in many cases, people actually don't know. One of the surprising things that Brett and I found when we were interviewing people in television and other areas, but especially in television, people who, you know, we would have thought knew rather more about the subject than we did, they were asking us what we thought was going to happen. There was a kind of reversal of roles. You know, we were we ended up pontificating as, you know, almost instant experts, and so we're quite excited by that transition. And I think that shows the uncertainty that many people have in the world of media sport. All these changes, as we say, have happened. Television is still dominant, but its domination is mutating in some way. How will that change? Not very many people know that.
Brett and David, in your chapter on televised sport and the internet, you write about online piracy of broadcast. So what kind of a problem is this, and who pays the greatest price for piracy?
Piracy is an interesting one, because up until recent years, when broadband speeds hit a point where, you know, getting a live stream that doesn't buffer every, you know, 30 seconds wasn't much of a problem until recently. But it was interesting because, of course, we saw all the controversies around Napster and music downloading a number of years ago, and sports sort of watched on, or the sports industries and leagues watched on with, you know, an eye on the problem while not really being affected by it. In the last few years, sports piracy and basically the unauthorized streaming of live sports events from around the world has become a significant problem, according to various sports organizations. There's, of course, lots of debates around what the actual impact is. Some of the figures that get thrown about at what's its cost us in terms of pay television subscription and advertising, frankly, beggar belief. But there is no doubt that there has been an impact. And it's the reason it's a problem is, of course, like most forms of piracy on the internet, it's extremely hard to locate and do anything about. So streaming sites pop up and disappear, and a significant percentage of what is referred to as online sports piracy is coming out of China. The cricket, various international cricket bodies have come together because of various problems with piracy based in different areas of the subcontinent. And what it's really doing is speaking to the dismantling of exclusivity. And that's a dominant theme in the book, and it's a dominant theme around why live sport is so important. If you do not have exclusivity over that game, that live event, the value and the rights demanded drop for the league. And of course, advertisers say, "Well, why should I pay for this when it's not really clear where it's going?" And some of the sports organisations are quite forward-looking, so they've made their events available online in as many ways as possible, just seeking to chase the biggest audience as possible. And some have taken a much more defensive and even aggressive mindset around, you know, saying that it can only be available on this channel on pay television, and that's the way we want it. And you've seen, for example, the English Premier League in the UK appeal to the UK government for help with this problem because of the hurt that it's claiming that it does financially to the league. And like the movie industry, some of those claims deserve consideration, and some of them, I would argue, are a form of industry rent seeking. But it really does depend on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, if I could just add there, I mentioned at the start of the program that my early work, my PhD, was in popular music. So this is always a trip down memory lane whenever we talk about piracy, because, you know, when I was doing my postgraduate work in the late 70s, early 80s, in the music industry, it was all about so-called home taping. There was a massive, mm-hmm. you know, argument about home taping. It seems rather quaint now that people used to, you know, used to be concerned about playing vinyl records and using you know, audio tape to record it. And I mean, there are many. You're a cultural historian, so you would know this, Bruce. That there are many parallels here. That almost exactly the same arguments are run. The same gross level of exaggeration of how big the problem is and how much money is being lost, and so on. Now, it is happening. I think it's comparatively minor at the moment, I think, in terms of the, you know, the total sports market, but clearly the new digital technologies facilitate piracy. But again, there is a question, you know, that we would continue to ask, which is why does piracy happen? Does it happen because people are bad, because they never ever want to pay for anything, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it the case that often the cost of the product is too high, or the restrictions imposed on accessing it mm-hmm. are too great? You know, these are the, I think, important questions. We always, I think, have to be very skeptical about piracy when it is claimed that it is destroying an industry. And one of the things I would also point out about piracy is that in some cases, especially in immature markets, it's a form of advertising. So that, you know, if an audience for Australian rules football is found in parts of South America and Africa through pirate broadcasts, well, it's probably to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. I think that the fundamental contradiction there is that over the course of the project, which, you know, is based on 3 years' research, the value of most, but not all, but most television contracts for the coverage of sports leagues and competitions and events continued to increase, despite the so-called plague of piracy that was claimed in some quarters. So what we do try and make a case for in the book is around the use of the rhetoric of piracy, and that establishing the actual impact of piracy in any of the major media industries is extremely hard to do with this incredibly heightened and alarmist rhetoric, and that a more measured and, you know, the example David gave is a good one. You know, looking at the multiple impacts, both positive, negative, and negligible, And certainly I remember when we were writing that section of the book, I was walking away from interviews with claims of audiences of tens of thousands for pirate streams, and then going home and with a certain amount of anxiety because of my own internet service provider searching for streams of particular matches and, you know, finding a dozen of them and still not being able to come up with an audience of more than 4,000 according to the number of viewers at those moments. So, you know, there is no doubt that the major sports events like television will attract comparatively or proportionately large audiences, but week-to-week matches and so on are a much more difficult thing to get a hold of.
David, thank you for reminding me of, I recall my criminal activity with my teenage friends down in the basement recording albums. We just felt like we were, you know, the FBI was going to rush in any minute and take away our album. So let me turn to, in the book you talk about online media, and I don't know the term you use exactly, I'll call them minor sports. So things like cycling, running, sports other than the major team-based sports. And we might assume that with the opening of media in the online age, that these sports would benefit, that they're no longer, that they have access to media as opposed to having to go through the networks which restrict themselves to team sports. Is that the case? Have these other sports benefited in the internet age?
The answer to that in most cases is a resounding no, in my opinion. There is evidence, of course, at the edges at certain events, if they manage to set up a live stream, may pick up a small audience. But the overall picture that emerges is that the resource advantages enjoyed by the major sports and the big leagues, usually men's professional leagues, has been extended by the advent of digital media. And this goes against a lot of what was in the literature around the democratising effects of digital culture and digital technologies. And what's occurred, of course, is in a 24/7 media schedule, the delivery of fresh, polished, professional and engaging content is a very resource-intensive activity. So competitions like the NFL, Major League Baseball in Australia, things like the AFL and the National Rugby League are much better positioned to offer you fans that content across all those screens, mobile, tablet, computer, laptop, as well as television, both free-to-air and on cable or pay. And in other words, fans now have more opportunity to consume more content than ever before about the same sports that have been watched for decades. And at the margins, people might, you know, people who are enthusiasts or participants in smaller sports are certainly able to probably get more than they've got in the past, but it hasn't translated into advantage in the marketplace. So sponsorship, spectators and media coverage. So, and this, as I say, I think is one of the reasons why sport's such an important case study in diffusing some of the more utopian rhetoric that goes on around digital media, because the amateurs and the semi-professionals, the disabled, many women's competitions haven't benefited particularly much from the advent of digital media. In fact, in many cases, they've fallen further behind.
Dave and Brett, I want to turn to fans' activities in social media and online communities. And this would seem to be an area of great potential for leagues and for clubs to foster greater links with their supporters. But you make the point in your book that online fan communities are often a big problem for clubs. And clubs often feel the need to intervene and even censor what goes on in these fan communities. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, look, fans by definition, you know, in most areas of cultural activity tend to be pretty passionate. And, of course, you combine that with the general tone of debate and argument online and you get a pretty volatile picture emerges. So clubs, in a lot of ways, have used digital media to intensify their connections with fans in the commodified sense of trying to sell tickets, season memberships, merchandise and so on. But the independent fan discussion that goes online has been a much more difficult thing to control. And this has probably been most obvious in things like the discussion boards frequented by often overly dedicated ones like fans who spend a lot of time of their time commenting on the various issues around the club. And occasionally you've seen, and you will see, and you've seen it in any number of countries, potentially defamatory comments made by fans, or particularly nasty outbursts over a recent loss or disappointment or abuse of a player who's decided to leave the club and take up a contract elsewhere. And that makes fans both, you know, in the sense of being able to connect with fans, both a potential resource but also a potential problem. And that the dynamic between the two is one of the harder ones for social media managers and digital media managers to actually handle. And we sort of detail a number of examples in the book where clubs and so on have experienced those difficulties.
Yeah, and of course the other hot spot is around intellectual property. So, you know, where do clubs jump on fan groups who may, as they see it, be infringing, you know, their intellectual property? Now, as far as the fans are concerned, they're just being fans. You know, they're not trying to make money in most cases, and they're not too fussed about who owns what image, you know, still or audiovisual, etc. But of course, that is what the club is, you know, is keen to protect. So there's there are various conflicts there, and also as Brett suggested, you know, there is a level of incivility that is typical of fan groups. I mean, they are fanatical. That's what the fans, you know, fans are shortening of the term fanatical and or fanatic. And for some people, they get, you know, they get very angry and they get defamatory and so on. You know, there are always accusations that someone's got their fingers in the till and, you know, is siphoning off money or whatever. Some of those might be true. Others, you know, clearly not. What do clubs do about it? If they come down too heavily, they will actually provoke precisely the reaction that they don't want, that they will actually cause more antagonism. Mm-hmm. So it is a delicate area, but fans have to be allowed to be fans, I would argue.
And let me be unreasonable. Let me follow up on that. And this is based on my visits to fan sites of the teams that I follow. It seems that there's a great deal of cynicism among fans about what the team officials and the team representatives say. And it strikes me, and I got this idea while reading the chapter in your book, it's almost like the cynicism toward politicians. So yes, our loyalty is with the club, but we have no trust for the people who actually run the club. And in fact, we're quite antagonistic toward the people. And there is something of, you know, there's this awareness of the club has a message, like a political party has a message, but we don't believe anything they're saying.
And it speaks to a deep contradiction of sport and, you know, sort of late capitalism, and that ownership is an emotional thing for many fans, but it's expressed through that. But these are professional sports clubs, and to belong involves money these days. You know, the idea of this nostalgia for, you know, sport pre-capitalism, mm-hmm. and, you know, sport in real community and real football is a trope, or an image that travels in many people's heads, that's where true belonging is. That, you know, my allegiance to the club transcends money and so on. But at the same time, the way that belonging that the club is expressed is by critiquing how others spend those resources that fans provide. So, you know, I've always been amazed by and indeed bemused by the contradiction that runs through a lot of contemporary professional sport, and that you see these constant emphases on branding that de-emphasises money. So it's about community, it's about belonging, it's about the positive associations the club offers a community. It's about the role of a club or a league in the community. Yet at the same time, the majority of sports clubs are businesses, and, you know, we'll admit that. And, of course, fans sort of see both sides of that. And there's also a term in, it comes through in a little bit of the literature, the notion of property in belonging. that we belong in a number of ways, and that belonging to the sport means I am allowed to criticise club officials, who most of the time, you know, at least going by the interviews, see themselves as simply doing their jobs and can't understand the deep frustration. But the moment you ask someone for money for a membership, there is a point that has been passed where they feel that they then have the right to express how that money's felt. And that's just similar with politicians, of course. One of the common things that goes through both examples, of course, is how do most peoples engage with communities and power and authority? And it's through media channels. And that, you know, you can see common but also quite distinct dynamics expressed through media as a result.
Dave and Brett, you have a chapter on sports journalism and online media. And for the book, you interviewed a number of newspaper, radio, and television journalists. And I'll ask you, what were the common concerns or even the fears that they have about the challenges of doing their work in the digital age?
I might take that one, Brett. I think their anxieties were, I think, maybe threefold. One was the quality of their work. The demands that were being imposed on them were so great, you know, multiple deadlines, and this is the whole problem, I think, with digital media. So that, you know, we spoke to sports journalists who are filing copy for the website here. They're writing a piece for tomorrow's newspaper there. They were doing a radio interview somewhere else, and they were lined up for television and so on. And they were just kind of hyperactive. So I think that was an area of concern. Secondly, apart from that, maybe loss of quality, that urge to be hyperactive and to work constantly, was the sense that they might become irrelevant or redundant, first through so-called citizen journalism, bloggers and non-professional journalists doing their thing and taking their audience. That was a bit of a concern about, you know, the craft of journalism. It was our pun, a leaking craft, we regard sports journalism as being. And another area of concern was that they were essentially being taken, their area of practice was being taken over by public relations, often run by sports associations, or organizations, or clubs. So that essentially, what was not really critical journalism was going out directly from the source. They were bypassing the middle person. This might also involve athletes who were refusing to speak to professional journalists because they thought that they could use Twitter and Facebook and so on to communicate directly with their fans in a quite a controlled way. So I think those areas suggested to us that, on the whole, sports journalists weren't a happy bunch. You know, we always used to say, nice work if you can get it. Well, the work is getting harder.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly the one area of sports media where the lowering of barriers to entry by amateurs, that sort of so-called the division between pro-am media or professional and amateur media, journalism is the one area where you do see that anxiety expressed. So particularly around particularly well-informed or thoughtful bloggers or people who are running social networking profiles and Twitter accounts that are running right alongside established so-called mainstream news outlets that have long enjoyed historical dominance. So that sense of crisis you see around a lot of the legacy media industry, particularly print, gets played out on the sports desk. Although, again, the picture varies from country to country. So, you still see a lot of routine reporting of sports. There's definitely a space for it. But perhaps the rewards aren't as great for those doing it. And secondly, there was genuine concern around the fact what of the role of critical, investigative sports journalism that tells, you know, the real stories going on behind what we see on screen, in that sort of sports journalism, long-form essays and so on, is under attack or certainly is struggling to find a sustainable economic model, whereas, you know, more PR, as David said, more PR-focused, celebrity-focused presentation of sport, you know, we see more and more of. So it's a question of it also complicates what journalism is, and this constant line between the public interest versus what's of interest to the public, entertainment versus information, and the traditional role of news that's been around for, you know, a good couple of hundred years, and sport's role in that, which has always been, as I say, probably ambivalent at best.
Well, David and Brett, we're almost out of time, and I'll ask to finish up what you both are working on right now.
I've moved on to I've been fortunate enough to be funded for a 4-year research fellowship looking into mobile communications and media and sport by the Australian Research Council. So I'm presently right at the start of a 4-year project, particularly focusing on tablets and smartphones, but also working with research partners in the UK, the US and China. As well as Australia. So it's very exciting. It's also sort of anxiety-inducing because of the scale of the project, but it's a problem I certainly enjoy having.
Mm-hmm. And David?
Yes, for my sins, I'm working on 3 main projects at the moment. One that is around sport, media and nation in Greater Western Sydney, the most diverse part of Australia. So I'm really interested in how people attach national identity to sport or detach it in various ways. And I'm also doing some work on the field of culture in Australia and its transnational dimensions. And I'm also doing something on cultural production and consumption. So, yes, plenty to keep me off the streets, or in some cases, on the streets.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming on the podcast.
You've been listening to an interview with Brett Hutchins and David Rowe about their book, Sport Beyond Television, The Internet, Digital Media, and the Rise of Networked Media Sport, published in 2013, by Routledge. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, law, and politics. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.